This is Lecture 4 in the series Capital, the Productive Process, and the Rate of Profit.
I hope once again you have the lecture supplement available to you. Let me begin by recapitulating some of the essentials of Saturday's lecture. Our purpose there was to find out what element among the various ones that we were considering was responsible for the generation of profit. Our basic source of data was figure 3, and we saw that we could infer an amount of profit. The information in figure 3 provided us with total sales revenues and total costs, and also total capital. Total capital was the cost value of the capital goods, the cost value of the consumer goods, plus the 1,000 units of cash to be paid out. If you look briefly back at figure 3, for example, in year 1, in the row opening assets of business, you can calculate from that information the total capital of business is 1,800, 400 cost value of the capital goods, 1,000 monetary units of cash, and 1C of consumer goods with a cost value of 400. And then we saw that the various transactions, the purchases of capital goods for 500, the payment of wages of 300, of dividends of 200, the consumption expenditure of the wages and dividends, that gave us 500 of sales revenue, along with a 500 from the demand for capital goods. That gave us 1,000 of sales revenue. Year after year, we had 1,000 of sales revenue. And we also had 800 of costs. In each year, the cost deducted from sales revenue reflected the productive expenditure of the year before. And I pointed out that productive expenditure, the outlays for the purpose of making sales, the expenditure to buy the capital goods and the expenditure to pay wages, those outlays showed up in the next year as costs and in the current year as sales revenues. And this process was repeated. And we came to the conclusion you couldn't get profits from productive expenditure because productive expenditure showed up equally in sales and costs. And to find profits, we needed to find a source of sales revenue that was beyond productive expenditure. And we found the source in the consumption of the owners and creditors of business. They consume, their consumption generates sales revenues, but it does not show up in costs. Or in the case of interest payments, it doesn't show up in the cost that we're considering. Now, you can see the significance of the consumption of the owners and creditors of business in terms of a simple formula at the bottom of page 12. Our objective, remember, is to show what allows sales revenues to exceed productive expenditure. Well, sales revenues are the demand for capital goods, D sub K, plus the demand for consumer goods, D sub C. Productive expenditure is the demand for capital goods, D sub K, plus the demand for labor, D sub L. Well, the difference between sales revenues and productive expenditure is shown in line D under point 3. Sales revenues minus productive expenditure equal D sub K plus D sub C, demand for capital goods and demand for consumer goods, minus productive expenditure, which is D sub K and D sub L. When we perform the subtraction, what it reduces to is the demand for consumer goods minus the demand for labor. Sales revenues exceed productive expenditure because the demand for consumer goods exceeds the demand for labor. Consumption spending exceeds wages. And that, in the context of an economy with an invariable money, is the permanent abiding source of profit. And the name I gave to it was net consumption. Consumption over and above wages. I call it net consumption. All right, this morning I'd like to begin by explaining the role of increases in the quantity of money and volume of spending in influencing the average rate of profit. Up to now, we've been reasoning in terms of invariable money, a fixed quantity of money, a fixed volume of spending. Now, for a brief time, we will relax that assumption so that we will have some awareness of what the effect of a growing quantity of money actually is. And what I have done to provide the basis of this analysis is provide you with figure 3A, profits on page 17 of the supplement, titled Profits in an Economy with an Increasing Quantity of Money. And figure 3A, in every essential respect, is a repetition of figure 3. The one vital difference is I'm incorporating a compound increase in the quantity of money and volume of spending. Year 1 of figure 3A is fully identical with year 1 of figure 3. But in year 2, instead of the cash to be paid out being 1,000 units of money, I've assumed it's become 1,100. Why 1,100? Well, I told you 10% is my favorite percentage. It's the easiest for me to compound. All right, in year 2, we open, the only difference between year 2 and year 1 is that we're opening with more money. The transactions in year 2 are going to be affected. Instead of the demand for capital goods being 500, they'll be 10% more, 550. Instead of wages being 300, they'll be 330. Dividends, instead of being 200, will be 220. Consumer sales revenues will be 550. The spending to buy consumer goods will be 550. All right, what do we have here that's different, that's vital to profit, compared with figure 3? What's happened to sales revenues? What are total sales revenues? They're 1,100 instead of 1,000. Now, what has happened to costs? What are the costs to be deducted from these sales revenues? Pardon me? In year 1, what are the costs to be deducted from the sales revenues? I'm sorry, in year 2. In year 2, what are the costs to be deducted from sales revenues? How many of you are saying 880? How many of you say something else? What do you say? Are you saying 800? I agree with those who say 800. If you look at year 2, there's 550 of spending to buy capital goods. Demand for capital goods is 550. What is the cost value of that 1K of capital goods that is purchased for the 550? It's only 400. What's the cost value of the 1C of consumer goods in year 2 that's purchased for 550? 400. Now, where did these cost values come from? The expending in the previous year, the spending back in year 1. In year 1, only 500 was spent for capital goods, not 550. Only 300 was spent for labor, not 330. There is a time lag, which is of vital significance to the influence of the increase in money on the rate of profit. So notice, sales revenues have gone up, but costs don't immediately rise because costs reflect the lower level of productive spending of the year before. Costs are still geared to the lower level of productive spending of the year before. So now, if we have sales revenues of 1,100 and we still have costs of 800, well, what's happened to profit? Profit is 300. All right, now let's carry it forward another year. Let's repeat the same basic idea in year 3. In year 3, what happens to the cost value if you look at the opening assets of business in year 3? What is the cost value of the 1K of capital goods? 440, and the cost value of the 1C of consumer goods is 440, because now to produce these goods, 880 was spent. In year two, $550 was spent for the capital goods and $330 for the labor. So now the cost values have risen. But what's happened to the quantity of money in year three? It's risen a further 10%. It's no longer $1,100, it's $1,210. And what happens to the spending for capital goods? Will it remain at $550? It goes up a further 10%. It's now $605. And the wages go up a further 10%. They're $363. And the dividends a further 10%. They're $242. The spending for consumer goods will be $605. So what is profit if now we have total sales revenues of $1,210 and total costs of $880? Profits will be $330. And if we carry it out another year, we'll find that profits will be $363. Sales revenues will be $1,321. Costs will be, I believe, $968. Profits will be higher. Now, what I do in Table 6, which is right across from Figure 3A, Table 6 is built on the information of Table 3A, and it extends that information. It carries it a little bit further. I'm showing a series of years, 5 years, a little more than in Figure 3A. I'm showing the quantity of money in each of those years with an increase of 10%. I'm showing net consumption in each of those years growing at 10% compounded. I'm showing productive expenditure starting with 800 and growing 10% compounded. Productive expenditure is represented by B, business spending. D stands for the cost deducted from sales. I have to use D rather than C because C is already claimed by consumption. So costs reflect the productive expenditure in the year before. Notice in year two, costs are still 800, because that's what productive expenditure was in year one. In year three, costs are 880. That's what productive expenditure was in year two. There's a one-year lag. Now, on the basis of a knowledge of net consumption and productive expenditure, if we add those two, we have sales revenue, headed by S. The column headed S is sales revenue, and that's simply the sum of the net consumption column plus the productive expenditure column. That's sales revenues. And to get profit, all we do is subtract from the sales revenues the items under D, the costs. So we've got an amount of profit, 200, then it's 300, then it's 330, 363, 399. And it would go on like that. Now, we also have information for capital. Capital, which is the opening assets of business, begins as 1,800, and then it goes up 10%. It'll be 1,980, and then 2,178, 2,396, 2,635. And we can compute the rate of profit year by year. All we have to do is divide the amount of profit in each year by the amount of capital. And I do that. I have a column P over K in percent. P divided by K in percent. Well, 200 over 1,800 is the rate of profit we started with, 11.11%. And then if we're dividing 300 by 1980, and then 330 by 2178, we'll see that we have a new higher rate of profit of 15.15%. So notice, we have this increase in the quantity of money, and there is a definite significant increase in the rate of profit. Now, when I first worked this table out, I was frankly very much surprised by the fact that the addition to the rate of profit is only about 4%. I was expecting something very close to 10%. And I think the actual truth is that If we had any continuing rate of increase in money and spending, it would tend to add to the nominal rate of profit a number of percentage points, at least approximately equal to the rate of increase in money and spending. What I really believe is that with a 10% increase in money and spending, we should have virtually a 10% addition to the rate of profit. We should expect the rate of profit to come out, instead of 15%, it should be closer to 21%. It should be roughly 10% higher than it was to start with. Now, I figured out why in this particular example it's not showing up that way, and what needs to be done to make it approximate the increase in the quantity of money, the extra profit added. What's the problem here is that in this imaginary economy, money is playing far too great a role. We have 1,000 units of money, and that's more than half the total capital of the economy. Now, that's a gross exaggeration of the relative size of money in business assets. I did it to make things very, very simple. We'll just follow the spending of the money one time in the year, and that's it. But it would be instructive to just get an idea of what would happen if we reduced the relative significance of money. We could reproduce this kind of table, and instead of starting with a quantity of money of 1,000, we could start with a quantity of money of 100 and let that grow 10%. We'd have 100, 110, 121. Now, just notice, if we did that, the addition to the rate of profit that would result from a 10% increase in money and spending would, in fact, be much closer to 10%. See, let me point out, incidentally, if we say we had a lower quantity of money and we have the same total spending, each unit of the money would be spent a multiple number of times. To have 1,000 of sales revenue with 100 of money, each unit of money in the year would have to be spent 10 times in making purchases from business. That's not unreasonable in the context we're working with. All right, if we had an initial quantity of money of 100, that would mean our total initial capital, instead of being 1,800, would be 900. We'd have our 1K of capital goods at 400, our 1C of consumer goods at 400, and we'd have 100 of money. We would have 900 of capital. Well, what would be our initial rate of profit if instead of 1,800 of capital and 200 of profit, we have 900 of capital and 200 of profit? 22%. It would be double. And now, what will be the rate of profit if the amount of profit goes to 300? It would be in the neighborhood of, if it's 300 over 900, it would be 33%. Now notice what has happened to the increase in the rate of profit if we view it this way. If our initial rate of profit is 22%, without the increase in the quantity of money, and now when we factor in the increase in the quantity of money, the new rate of profit that we come up with is somewhere in the low 30s, what kind of increment has been added to the rate of profit? What order of magnitude? On the order of 10%. 10%, 10 extra percentage points. Okay, sorry, temporary pause. All right, if, in other words, we make the significance of money less, it doesn't retard the addition to the rate of profit as it does in this example. Now, we don't even have to do that. There is another way that we would find the increase in the rate of profit approximating the rate of increase in the quantity of money. And this will apply whether the quantity of money is as great as I've initially assumed it, if it's 1,000 or if it's 100. And it will make the addition to the rate of profit conform approximately to the rate of increase in the quantity of money. And I'm saying that if money and spending are going up 10%, whatever the rate of profit otherwise would have been, it now ought to be roughly 10% more. If it was 5%, now it should be 15%. If it was 12%, now it should be 22%. On and on. Well, think about this for a moment. Suppose we had a full gold standard as our money. The money was either physical units of gold or paper 100% backed by gold. Now, let's consider the gold mining industry. The physical product of the gold mining industry is gold. The gold mining industry, in a gold standard, does not sell the gold. The gold is the money. Well, what we would have to do under a gold system is add to business sales revenues the physical output of the gold mining industry. You see, the gold mining industry has costs. What is its revenue? What does it deduct its costs from? The gold that it mines. So the additional quantity of money itself under a metallic system, the additional quantity of money itself should be added to sales revenues. It's not just the spending of that money, it's the physical production of that money that for the gold mining industry is the equivalent of sales revenues. A gold mining concern under a gold standard spends 100 ounces of gold for labor, equipment, etc., and then digs out of the ground 105 ounces. And that 105 is its revenue. Well, that whole 105 should be added to sales revenues in the economy and would increase the amount of profit to its full extent. Now, how's that? Well, let's say here's our gold mining concern. It digs out of the ground 105 ounces of gold. Its costs are 100 ounces of gold. Now, you might say, all right, I understand how profits could be 5 ounces of gold bigger, but I'm telling you they're 105 ounces of gold bigger. How do I get 105? Well, let's consider the gold mining industry spends 100 ounces of gold to mine its gold. What does that do to the spending of other industries to produce their product? If capital and labor have to be employed in gold mining, what happens to the funds available for the other industries? They're reduced by the 100. So now we have the same total outlays in the economy, the same total productive expenditure, but we've got the extra physical output of the gold mining industry. Now, if you crank that in, even in the way I have table 6, even with the quantity of money being 1,000, if you do that, if we add to the amount of profit the increase in the quantity of money itself year by year, and I show that far over on the right in the third from last column, if we add to the amount of profit the physical increase in the quantity of money, well then profit plus the increase in the quantity of money, it goes from 200 to 400 to 440, 484, on and on. And if we divide that larger amount by capital, the rate of profit, instead of going to 15.15%, goes to 20.2%, and then the addition to the rate of profit is 9.09. All right, maybe this is too much explanation for a point that isn't that vital to what we have to do, but I just want to establish the idea, make it as plausible to you as I can, that the rate of increase in the quantity of money and volume of spending adds at least an approximately equal number of percentage points to the average rate of profit and interest. If there's no increase in money and spending, the permanent abiding source of the rate of profit is the rate of net consumption, the ratio of net consumption to capital. If we have an increase in quantity of money, then the rate of profit is greater than that, approximately by an amount equal to the rate of increase in money and spending. At least approximately. And I even suspect it might be exact, but it's definitely approximate. All right, now, as you're listening to this, you might have the idea, isn't this just simply inflation? Well, it incorporates the case of inflation. If you realize that the increase in money and spending adds to the nominal rate of profit, well, that's important. And in inflation, that addition can become very, very large. In Brazil and Argentina, the rate of profit and interest is far into the triple digits. And that comes from the fact you buy anything, you turn around to sell it, you'll sell it for vastly more than you paid to buy it or to produce it. You can see it. All right. But the addition to the rate of profit connected with the increase in money and spending is not always a question of inflation. On page 18, I have an item titled Increases in Production and Increases in the Real Rate of Profit. Increases in production and increases in the real rate of profit. Now, let's suppose we have some increase in money and spending going on, adding to the nominal rate of profit, the money rate of profit, but at the same time, we also have increases in physical production and supply. Now, what would happen if, let's assume, year in and year out, we have a 2 or 3% annual increase in the quantity of money and volume of spending, and at the same time, we have a 2, 3, 4, or 5% increase in the physical production and supply of goods. All right, let's start off. We'll assume money and production are going up at the same rate. Suppose we've got a 2% annual increase in money and spending. If what I've told you a few minutes ago is correct, what should be the effect on the nominal rate of profit? If we've got a 2% annual increase in money and spending, what should that roughly do to the nominal rate of profit? Add 2% to it. Make it 2 points more than it would have been. All right, now, if there's no increase in production and supply, what will happen to prices? Prices would go up by about 2%. Would you have any greater real profit? No. All right, but suppose production and supply goes up by 2%. Then prices are the same. You've still got the addition to your money rate of profit, but what's happened to the real rate of profit? That's also gone up 2%. Now, what would happen? Let's suppose there's no increase in money and spending. There's only the increase in production and supply. Production and supply are going up 2% a year. If there's no increase in money and spending, what will happen to prices? Prices will fall on the order of 2%. What happens to the buying power of any given amount of capital together with its income? It will rise correspondingly. Let's imagine, here you are, you invest $100 at the beginning of the year, your monetary rate of profit is 5%. So you finish the year with $105. Now, if prices fell 2% during that year, you would still end with $105. But what would be the buying power of 105 in terms of the year before? It would be on the order of 107. Well, what would be the effect on your real rate of profit or interest as the result of the increase in production and fall in prices? All right. We start off, you have $100. You end with $105. Your rate of profit or interest is 5%. Now, if production and supply go up 2%, prices will fall. Prices will equal 100 over 102. If production and supply go up 2%, if we have the same spending to buy 2% more goods, well, we have to divide the given amount of spending by 1.02. Prices would be approximately 98% of what they were. Well, what happens if you have $105 and prices are 100/102 of what they were? We're dividing by 100/102. Prices are 100/102 of what they used to be. Well, this is equivalent to multiplying 102 over 100 times 105. We're multiplying, we're increasing your real rate of gain on the order of 2%. You will have roughly a 7% real rate of gain. Now, a principle here is increases in production and supply add a component to the real rate of profit. Increases in production and supply add a corresponding component to the real rate of profit. If production and supply could grow 10% a year, what would be the effect of that on prices if there were no increase in money and spending? Prices would be 10/11 of what they were. Whatever money you earned would buy correspondingly more. We'd have a substantial addition to your real rate of profit. Now, what adds to the money rate of profit is the increase in money and spending. What adds to the real rate of profit is the increase in production and supply. If both are going on at the same rate, well, then we have an equivalent addition to both. If we have production and supply going up 5% a year and money and spending going up 5% a year, what happens to prices? They're stable. What happens to your nominal rate of profit? It goes up by the full 5 points. It's a higher nominal and real rate of profit. If we have money and spending and production and supply going up at the same rate, prices are stable, the addition to money and spending adds to the nominal rate of profit. The addition to production and supply adds to the real rate of profit. Now, under the conditions of a gold standard, there would be some significant relationship. If we're going to have broad-ranging increases in production and supply of shoes, television sets, houses, automobiles, etc., etc., well, what is almost certain to be happening to the state of mining? There should be increases in mining. And what should we expect about precious metal mining? That should be increasing too. Well, under a gold standard, if we have a progressing economy, the leading fundamental aspect is there's a growing production of all kinds of goods and services. That increase in the production of goods and services represents an addition to the real rate of profit. As a byproduct of the process of increasing production, there will also almost certainly be some increase in the supply of gold and the spending of money. So there will also be, as a byproduct, an addition to the nominal rate of profit. In a progressing economy under a gold standard, we could have a high real rate of profit reflecting rapid increases in production, and we would have some addition also to the nominal rate of profit reflecting the increase in money. Now, I would not call this inflation. Notice It would be perfectly possible, suppose under gold, the increase in production of gold is 2% a year, and the increase in the production and supply of ordinary goods is 5% a year. All right, the increase in gold adds 2% to the nominal rate of profit. Money and spending are going up 2%. If production and supply are going up 5%, what's happening to prices? They'd be dropping 3%, but what happens to the real rate of profit? The real rate of profit goes up a full 5%. 2% it goes up in nominal terms, corresponding to the increase in money and spending, and it goes up a further 3%, corresponding to a fall in prices. Now, is this inflation? Is it deflation? Now you see, we have an increase in money. Some people, if you think that the standard of inflation is any increase in money, then you're led to call this inflation. More people think that deflation is any fall in prices. Well, is this inflation? It's not inflation. Is it deflation? No, it is neither. Now, I think it's a mistake to think of inflation as any increase in the quantity of money. And I myself used to think of it that way for many years. But if you think of inflation as any increase in the quantity of money, you're in the uncomfortable position of thinking that even under a gold standard, inflation is an inevitable, inescapable fact of reality, and then it's only a question of degree. Is there going to be a little bit or a lot? Well, I would say the increase in the quantity of gold under a gold monetary system, that's not inflation. Inflation should be measured as beginning at the point of the quantity of money increasing more rapidly than the gold. We should not view the increase in the gold as inflation, but an increase in paper over and above the increase in gold. Then we're not locked into the problem of inflation being an inevitable fact of existence. And there are no problems, really, with a modest increase in gold. All the problems we associate with inflation begin when the quantity of money starts to grow more rapidly than gold. Now, as we'll see very shortly, there's no basis for calling falling prices under these conditions, or under the conditions even of a constant quantity of money, there's no basis for calling that deflation. Deflation should be thought of in terms of a decrease in the quantity of money. Deflation should be thought of in terms of a decrease in money and spending, not a fall in prices. Notice, if you think that falling prices caused by rising production, if you think that that's deflation, well, somewhere in the back of your mind, you're going to have the idea that this means depression. Deflation and depression are interlinked. Well, then, if we have rising production and falling prices, what will you fear? What will you long for? You'll be fearing depression, and you'll be fearing production. See, if you think deflation is falling prices under any circumstances, even if caused by more production, then you have to fear production and long for the increase in money. We'll see that you never have to fear production. The increase in production does not in any way bring about deflation. All right, this takes me now into the main material I wanted to get into, presented in Figure 4, profits in a progressing economy with an invariable money. We're going back now to the assumption the quantity of money is fixed. We want to analyze things in that light, but we already now know what happens when the quantity of money increases, so every so often we can take a look over at the effects of the increase in the quantity of money, and we can note the differences. But our primary focus is going to be, once again, on the invariable money. figure 4 stands in the same relationship to figure 2 as figure 3 stood to figure 1. What we have here is figure 2 with the relative production of capital goods in a progressing economy. We're just adding in the monetary elements. And we're also showing a transition phase. We're showing the actual transition from a stationary to a progressing economy. In year 1 of figure 4, we have exactly the same conditions as in year 1 of figure 3, with one difference. If we look at the opening assets of business in figure 4, they're exactly the same as they were in figure 3. The one difference is down at the production stage. In year 1, in figure 4, production shifts to conform to the change in the relative demand for capital goods and consumer goods that is going to take place in year 2. In year 2, the demand for capital goods rises to 600, the demand for consumers' goods falls to 400. And what brings this about is, let's say, businessmen worry less about their property being confiscated by the government. So instead of trying to eat, drink, and be merry while they may, and paying themselves 200 of dividends which they consume, they cut back the dividends to 100, and they use that 100 to purchase additional capital goods. And in year 1, production gears to that coming change in demand. All right, well, all we have to do is trace out what happens over the years. Production is going to be 60% capital goods, 40% consumer goods. In year 2, we're going to have 1.2K of capital goods. And I'm showing a cost value of 480. Well, how do I get that cost value of 480? I apply 60% to the 800 that was spent in year 1 for capital goods and labor. And I have a cost value of 320 for the consumer goods of year 2. That's 40% applied to the 800. All right, now, in year 2, there's actually going to be 600 spent to buy the capital goods, 400 for the consumer goods. Wages are 300, dividends are 100. Consumer spending reflects the reduction in dividends. There's a reduction in net consumption. All right, now, production in year 2 takes place with the aid of 1.2K of capital goods, which are acquired for 600 units of money, and 1L of labor acquired for 300 units of money. And production is devoted 60% to consumer goods, 60% to capital goods, 40% to consumer goods. And now we arrive at a new set of cost values. The cost value of the 1.44K of capital goods in year 3, that's 540. Where do I get that 540? It's 60% of the 900. See, spending for factors of production in year 2 is greater than year 1. It's 900, not 800. And we get the cost value of consumer goods are 360, that's 40% of the 900. All right, now, from this point on, does anything change except the increase in production? If we compare the different types of spending in year 4 with year 3, is there any difference? We again have 600 of spending for capital goods, again 300 of wages, 100 of dividends, 400 of consumer demand. All right, well, let's consider what has happened to profits and how far does it go. In year 1, what were profits? What's profit in year 1? I'm sorry? 200. Capital is 1,800. The rate of profit is 2 over 18. Now, in year 2, what are profits? They're still 200. If you look at sales revenues, what are sales revenues in year 2? They're 1,000, they're 600 plus 400. What are the total costs deducted from the sales revenues? 800. Profits are still 200. There's a difference in which sector of the economy has the greater part of the costs. There's a shifting. The capital goods sector shows a bigger portion of the 800 of costs. The consumer goods sector, a smaller portion. All right, now what happens to total costs in year 3? In year 3, total costs are 900. What makes them 900 in year 3? We have greater productive expenditure in year 2. We had 900 of productive expenditure in year 2. In year 1, we only had 800 of productive expenditure. So in year 2, costs were only 800. In year 2, productive expenditure goes to 900. So in year 3, costs go to 900. In year 3, productive expenditure continues at 900. What will be costs in year 4? 900. Now, if we keep this up indefinitely, if productive expenditure is 900 and costs are 900 and sales revenues are 1,000, what's the amount of profit in every year from year 3 on? 100. What's the amount of capital in every year from year 3 on? In monetary terms, what is the monetary amount of capital reading the opening assets of business? I'm sorry? I hear many different answers. What's the cost value of the capital goods in year 3? Yes? 1,900 is the total capital. We get that from the fact that the cost value of the capital goods is 540, the cost value of the consumer goods is 360, and the cash is 1,000. Now, if you were reading any kind of balance sheet or income statement, and I'm not giving you economic theory here, I'm giving you standard business accounting. If you read the balance sheet of any business, they have assets, and you'll find dollar amounts connected to the assets. Like they'll show inventory, so many dollars. Plant and equipment, so many dollars. Where do the number of dollars that they're showing come from? Like when a business shows inventory at so many dollars, the number of dollars it shows corresponds to the dollars it paid out in the past to produce the inventory. If we paid 600 for the capital goods and 300 for the labor, what's going to show up as the value of the inventory? 900. Well, our analysis at this point is treating all the capital goods as though they were inventory. They're all being used up in the same year. They reflect the outlays of a past time, and we're assuming all of the past year. All right. From year 3 on, the amount of profit is 100. The amount of capital is 1,900. What does that imply about the rate of profit? If we divide 100 by 1,900, the rate of profit is now 5.26%. It used to be 11.11%. Now it's 5.26. All right. Now, my question to you is, what is happening to the supply of capital goods year by year? Year 3, year 4, year 24, it's increasing 20% a year. We have capital accumulation going on. What's happening to prices if every year we have more goods than the year before, in this example 20% more, but in every year we have the same spending? Prices are falling. Well, notice, can you see, in effect, before your eyes, that we have capital accumulation going on and prices falling and the rate of profit no longer falling? Can you see a lower but stable rate of profit accompanied by continuing capital accumulation and falling prices. Is that, in effect, the facts being shown in Figure 4? All right, what does it imply about the idea that capital accumulation requires a falling rate of profit? To what extent is there any truth in that? To what extent is that totally untrue? It's true for the transition to get the process going as far as capital accumulation depends on a rise in the relative production of capital goods, as far as it depends on a fall in the rate of net consumption, businessmen consuming less, devoting more to the purchase of capital goods. To that extent, we have a one-time, non-repeatable fall in the rate of profit. But once we get the extra capital goods, once we get in year two, 1.2K of capital goods instead of the 1K, what does the larger supply of capital goods do to our ability to produce not just more consumer goods, but also more capital goods? It increases it. Do we need a fresh rise in the relative production of capital goods for further capital accumulation? No. Capital accumulation continues on the strength of a sufficiently high relative production of capital goods. That larger supply of capital goods that results is itself the foundation for a still bigger supply. Once we get more capital goods, on that very basis, we can produce still more. It's easier to produce capital goods when you have more capital goods. See, capital goods are used to produce capital goods. They're not just used to produce the bread. They're used to produce everything. Capital goods are used in producing everything. So more capital goods themselves become a source of more capital goods as well as more consumer goods. And what do we need to sustain this process so that we don't encounter diminishing returns? Technological progress. Technological progress. Notice, how does technological progress enter into capital accumulation? Is it a source or a use? It's a source. Now, there's a whole famous doctrine in economics. They believe capital is accumulated simply by saving. And then they worry, well, what if we save too much and technology is not coming along providing sufficient uses for what we're saving? This was the doctrine in the 1930s known as secular stagnationism. And they were saying, in the 19th century, we were lucky. People were saving heavily. Thank God, canal building and then railroad building came along to use up all of the capital being accumulated by saving. That was the doctrine of Alvin Hansen, the teacher of Samuelson. Well, now, if you think about it, could any amount of saving out of the level of production of a sailboat ox cart economy have accumulated the volume of capital that was then invested in the railroad network and the steel mills? Could it be the case, here we are, we're producing with ox carts and sailing vessels, and somehow we're heaping up a volume of capital goods sufficient to build the railroad network and all the steel mills, only the railroads and steel mills haven't been invented. So we don't know what to do with all this capital. We have a glut of capital. Well, that's nonsense. We could never have had the capital to invest in those things if we didn't have these things starting. The fact that we got the first railroads of the 1830s, that enabled us to produce more capital goods than we could have if we didn't have those railroads. And the railroads of the 1830s were a critical part of the foundation of the railroads of the 1840s. And the better steel mills of the 1830s played a vital role in the better steel mills and railroads of the 1840s. Decade by decade, technological progress was, the capital goods being accumulated were being put into more advanced technologies, and the effect of that was to make possible still more capital accumulation. Technological progress is valuable not as a means of finding outlets for capital goods we're heaping up through saving. It's indispensable to providing the capital goods. That's the real economic contribution of technological progress. We don't need technology to give us uses for capital goods. We can find uses for more capital goods than we've got all the time. What we need technological progress for is to get the capital goods. Now, notice if we open an eye back to the effect of the increase in the quantity of money, suppose we have a fall in the rate of net consumption. Businessmen become more future-oriented. They're not as worried about being confiscated and so forth. They spend more heavily for capital goods. The economy becomes progressing. All right, the rate of net consumption has fallen, in our example, from 11% to 5.25%. Now we have a progressing economy. What should we actually expect to happen to the quantity of money if we have a gold monetary system? There should be some increase. And what will be the effect of that on the nominal rate of profit? Will the nominal rate of profit, in other words, fall all the way from 11.11% to 5.26% if we allow for the fact that an important byproduct of the progressing economy that's being established is some addition to the increase in the quantity of money? Now, the rate of profit, the fall in the rate of profit, will not go as far as corresponds to the fall in the rate of net consumption. There'll be a byproduct of some greater increase in gold, so maybe the nominal rate of profit, instead of falling to 5.26%, stabilizes at 7.5% or something like that. What goes on here is profits generated by net consumption to some degree are replaced by profits generated by the rate of increase in the quantity of money. That's what's involved. If we have the transition to a progressing economy, to some extent, profits generated by net consumption are replaced with profits generated by an increase in the quantity of money. And these are real profits because the context is a gold monetary system whose increase is a byproduct of the increase in production. Now notice, to whatever extent production is rising more rapidly than money, and certainly if we have a progressing economy with no increase in money, prices are going to fall. In figure 4, we can precisely measure the fall in prices. If we have 1,000 units of money being spent year in and year out to buy the product, and physically the product is growing at 20% per year, which it is in figure 4, well then prices each year are 1/6 below what they were the year before. Each year, production is higher in the ratio of 6 to 5, so prices stand in the ratio of 5 to 6. All right, but we still have a positive rate of profit. And the rate of profit can even have some addition by virtue of the increase in the supply of gold. Maybe it'll be prices don't fall 20%, they fall 15%, and the nominal rate of profit is 10%. It could be like that. All right, now I would like you to consider carefully, how, in any sense, does this deserve to be called deflation? What are ideas that we associate with deflation? Depression. Deflation and depression are almost synonyms. Now, in a depression, what happens to the general profitability of business? It goes way down, it can be virtually wiped out. What happens to the ability to repay debts? In a depression, you owe money and many, many people just can't earn the money to repay. All right, now here we have falling prices. We don't have a falling rate of profit. We have a one-shot, non-repeatable, limited reduction in the rate of profit. Thereafter, prices are falling. There's no further reduction in the rate of profit. There can even be somewhat of an addition based on the monetary component. What has happened to the ability to earn any given sum of money? If we have an economy in which production is rising, if your increase in production keeps pace with the average increase, if you can increase your production as fast as the economy-wide average, what does that do to your ability to earn a given sum of money? Imagine, in other words, you used to produce and sell 5 units of a product, and you would earn 1 unit of money. Now, prices have fallen. Prices are 5/6 of what they used to be. But how much goods will the average seller have to sell? 6/5. Well, now, if you have increased your production in pace with the economy-wide average increase, what's happened to the difficulty you have in earning a unit of money? It's unchanged. The average seller has 6 units to offer where he used to have only 5. Even if there's no more money, if you've increased your production in pace with the economy-wide average, it's just as easy for you to earn a dollar as it used to be. So how is it harder to pay a debt? It isn't. Now, there will be individuals who increase their production more rapidly than the average, and others who increase their production less rapidly. Those who increase more rapidly have an easier time repaying their debt. Those who increase less rapidly have a harder time. But is there any systematic process working against the interests of debtors as a class? Is the average debtor worse off as a result of the falling prices which result from more production? No. This does not deserve to be called deflation. What would make it more difficult for the average debtor to repay? Really make it harder to earn a unit of money? Yes? If the quantity of money was less. If there was less money, it doesn't matter what you're producing. Suppose production is the same, and now there's less money. Instead of 1,000 units of money being spent, there's only 750 units of money. All right, then it's going to be harder to earn a unit of money. Now, prices are going to fall. There'll be less money to buy the goods. So prices will fall. At the same time, it's harder to repay debts. But let's consider the relationship between the fall in prices and the greater difficulty of repaying debts. Is the fall in prices related to the greater difficulty of repaying debts as father to son or as a brother? Which is the cause of both? What's the cause of the greater difficulty of repaying debt and the fall in prices? The reduction in money and spending. If money and spending fall from 1,000 to 750, and we're trying to sell the same amount of goods, what happens to prices? They'll drop. What happens to the ability of the average debtor to earn any sum of money? It drops. It gets much harder. Well, now, what we're interested in is what is causing what? Is the fall in prices responsible for the greater difficulty of earning the money? Or is the fall in the quantity of money responsible both for the fall in prices and the greater difficulty? It's the fall in the quantity of money. That's the essential characteristic. That's what should be called deflation. Deflation is a monetary phenomenon. It has nothing to do with increases in production and the fall in prices brought about by more production. Inflation is a monetary phenomenon. See, if you think in terms of the invariable monetary analysis and reason it out, one of the main payoffs is it permits you to identify inflation and deflation as monetary phenomena, not phenomena of production. More production and the falling prices caused by more production do not wipe out profitability, do not make it harder to repay debts. But a fall in prices accompanying less money will do that. And if we had less money in spending, it would do that even if prices rose. Imagine money in spending fall to $7.50 and production falls fully in half. Money in spending fall to $7.50, but production falls all the way in half. What will happen to prices? They'll go up. But you owe a certain amount of money. What happens to your ability to earn the money to pay your debt? It's less, even though prices have risen. The essential is not the change in prices. The essential is the change in money and spending as far as inflation and deflation go. All right, there were further points I had hoped to get to this morning. I'll jump into them first thing tomorrow morning. But I think these two elements are of enormous significance. A falling rate of profit is not the necessary accompaniment of capital accumulation. A fall in the rate of profit may accompany the process at the beginning, but a further fall is not necessary. A further fall would be related as force to acceleration. We can have continuing capital accumulation with a constant rate of profit. We can have a constant rate of profit with falling prices. What is responsible for the rate of profit not having to fall is capital accumulation takes place on the strength of previous capital accumulation plus technological progress. We increase capital goods. That itself is the source of the ability to produce more capital goods, on and on, provided we have technological progress to sustain the process. When we get more goods, once the process gets underway, every fall in the price of consumer goods and the price of capital goods being produced today has already been preceded by an earlier fall in the price of capital goods. The prices of capital goods start to fall ahead of the prices of the products that result. The productivity of labor is higher. The effect of this is that unit costs fall ahead of selling prices. For example, in year three, the supply of capital goods increases from 1.2 to 1.44K. What is the effect of that on the price of capital goods if 600 is what's being spent for capital goods? The prices of capital goods go down. Now, what's the effect on the productivity of labor if 1L of labor, together with this 1.44K of capital goods, is now able to produce 20% more? How much output do we get per unit of labor? 20% more. Now, the selling price is going to be down 20%, but what's happened to unit costs? What's happened first to the price of the capital goods? They've gone down. If the productivity of labor goes up, what happens to your unit cost on account of labor? That drops. So in the process of falling prices due to increased production, the fall in prices comes to be preceded by a fall in the unit costs. And that's an aspect of seeing why the rate of profit does not fall or get wiped out. Okay, I'd like to stop here so we can take some questions. Thank you. Yes, this gentleman right here.
Under a gold standard, is it possible to have deflation? I can't quite fully hear you.
I forgot the first two ones.
Under a gold standard, is it possible to have deflation, assuming that the gold has been created and doesn't get destroyed?
All right, an excellent question. Is it possible under a gold standard to have deflation? And the answer is no. If we have a 100% reserve gold standard, meaning if every unit of money is a unit of gold or is 100% backed by gold. You see, under a 100% reserve gold standard, once the gold physically comes into existence, it's not going to evaporate out of existence. You might have a ship carrying gold sink, but that's not going to be too significant. Most of the time, the ship will be raised. There is fresh gold production. Under a full-body gold standard, we would have a modestly growing quantity of money. That would be the norm. And we would never have a decrease in the quantity of money. Usually, the advocates of a gold standard present its main advantage as it prevents inflation. That's perfectly true. But it's equally important that a 100% reserve gold standard prevents deflation. We would never have a basis for the wiping out of the rate of profit or the sudden inability of people to repay debts if we had a 100% reserve gold standard. See, what causes those problems is we have a monetary system such that the quantity can be decreased as well as increased. If you have a fractional reserve gold standard, where some of the money is gold or backed by gold, but most of it is backed by debt, then as soon as anything would occur to cause some bankruptcies, banks start to go broke, what used to be regarded as money ceases to be money. If you have a checking account at a bank that has failed, try writing a check. The quantity of money decreases, then you have a collapse in spending, sales revenues sink below costs, people can't repay their debts. Yes, this gentleman over here. Okay, you're saying it seems asymmetrical to you to call a decrease in gold deflation and not to call an increase in gold inflation. Is that the substance?
A decrease in the money supply. I realize gold, per se, would disappear. Yes,
all right. That's the substance. All right, I would call deflation a decrease in the money supply, whether it's gold or paper. And also, I think we could probably use the term deflation legitimately to refer to a sudden contraction of spending that might occur without a decrease in the quantity of money. You see, one of the consequences of increasing the quantity of money rapidly is it makes the money less desirable to hold, so people spend it faster. And then, as soon as you stop that rapid creation, they want to hold the money tighter again, and you get a contraction that way, even possibly without a decrease in money. I'd be prepared to call that deflation. Now, you look at the symmetry as, if there's less money, that's always deflation. Why isn't every increase in money to be called inflation? Well, I would have to answer you by saying that we don't want to regard inflation as the norm. If we're in a position in which inflation is inescapable, then the ground is cut from us in complaining about inflation. We have to have an idea of what is the basic normal state of affairs. Now, under capitalism, the normal state of affairs is economic progress, and an aspect of economic progress is going to be an increase in the supply of minerals and, to some extent, an increase in the supply of gold. I don't think we want to use the term inflation to refer to something that is a normal, necessary part of economic activity, even if it's not perfectly symmetrical. See, the norm would be some increase in the quantity of money. A modest increase within the bound of the increase in production, or only rarely, temporarily exceeding it. So I think we should reserve the term inflation for government-made increases in the quantity of money which will exceed the increase in gold. Inflation is not something we can denounce the normal private economy for. It's a matter of deliberate government policy in displacing gold, in encouraging fractional reserve banking, and then having total fiat money. Mr. Dunn.
Did Professor Mises share the view that you are now making with regard to increases in gold, monetary gold, not creating inflation, or did he look at it a different way?
All right, did Professor Mises share my view of increases in gold not representing inflation, or did he look at it another way? He looked at it a somewhat different way. He said the concepts inflation and deflation are not precise. And he would say we'd have to use the term inflation for certainly a big increase. Or that is not accurate. He preferred to talk in terms of inflationism and deflationism. If the government has a conscious policy of expanding the quantity of money, that's inflationism. The modest increase in gold, I don't think he would want to say is a problem of inflation. Now, let me digress for a second and give a devil his due. I think the one significant economic contribution of Rothbard is to have defined inflation as the increase in money over and above the increase in gold. He has a pamphlet, What Has Government Done to Our Money, where he has that definition, and it's correct. Subsequently, he's totally abandoned it, and now he says inflation is the rise in prices. So whatever insight he had, he's gone back on and lost. Plus, I also wanted to point out, Rothbard is an advocate of the idea that capital accumulation requires a continually falling rate of profit. And that was a subject, when I knew him many, many years ago, I had a three-year-long argument with him over that. I thought to claim the rate of profit has to fall in order for capital accumulation to occur is like saying we're in a world where the sun is gradually burning out. And so I was determined to show that the rate of profit did not have to fall. His view is it must. This is one major disagreement I have with him. I think that invalidates much of his analysis. There are many other areas. But the one thing that he has is the definition of inflation at one time. His main book, I don't think, has much value. But that little book, What Has Government Done to Our Money, that's something of significance. Yes, this gentleman here.
In the system that you describe, where we have capital goods and consumer goods, where does government spending fit? Legitimate or illegitimate?
All right, where does government spending come in? Or I assume you mean how do we classify government spending? Legitimate government spending for defense. All government spending is consumer spending. Now, I didn't go into the definitions here. I do in the tape series from last time, A Theory of Productive Activity, Saving, and Profit that Second Renaissance carries. What I mean by consumer goods is goods purchased not for the purpose of making subsequent sales. Capital goods are goods purchased for the purpose of making subsequent sales. Productive expenditure is expenditure for the purpose of making subsequent sales. Consumption expenditure, expenditure not for the purpose of making subsequent sales. These definitions are intimately bound up with the theory of profit I've been propounding. Only productive expenditures generate costs. Productive expenditures end up being deducted from sales revenues sooner or later. Consumption expenditures are not a deduction from sales revenues. Government spending is almost always I think by virtual necessity, not for the purpose of making subsequent sales. The government does not employ an army and then rent its services. The government spends, it uses up the funds, and that's why the next year it has to turn to the taxpayers for more. When a business spends, it recoups the funds in the sales revenues. A business is self-sustaining, and the profit it makes is its source of growth. A consumer uses up the funds and needs an outside source of funds. The government is a paramount consumer. All of its employees are consumers' labor. Yes, Mrs. Spiker.
Yes. On page 16, table 6, how do you get K? Is that the sum of capital M, capital B?
Or page 16, table 6, how do I get K?
Is it the sum of the opening assets, or is
yes.
it the sum?
Okay, you know, you see 1900, right?
Yeah.
All right, I noticed that this morning as I was talking to you, and you found a mistake. The capital in year two should be 1900, but the next year it'll be 1980. Thank you very much, it was very astute of you.
Table 6, as it appears on page 16, has been revised, and the revision appears on page 34 of the handout.
Edith.
I have a pretty different question.
Okay.
Why do you use the word demand instead of sales? Every time I have to look at the demand, I have to remember that you mean sales.
Why do I use the term demand rather than sales? I would use them both. They're the same thing seen from different perspective. The demand is from the perspective of the buyer, the sales from the perspective of the seller.
But if you want to see when you're figuring sales revenues minus cost and all that, if you have demand, what is that mistake?
Well, yes. But you see, let's consider how the sales originate. The sales originate, business has cash, and it uses the cash to make a demand. The firms go out and they buy capital goods. They're generating it. The sellers have the sales revenues. So it's buying and selling. The buyers are initiating it. But you could look at it either way. And earlier, when I had a little digression on national income accounting, I did it from the perspective of sales. And you may notice I even have a footnote down here, let me just find this. On page 12, there's a footnote at the bottom of page 12. I say, in terms of the previous discussion of national income accounting, D sub K equals S sub B. Well, D sub K is the demand for capital goods. S sub B is sales revenue paid from productive expenditure. And D sub C is S sub C. So I translate the terms. Sometimes you have to use different contexts. Yes, Mr. Kalis.
Yes, how do you put your in context what happened in the California gold rush when you had the large inflationary prices in the Bay Area? I don't know if I'd like for you to elaborate.
Okay, in the California gold rush of 1848, there was a sudden major increase in the supply of gold, and transportation was very primitive, and I've read stories that an egg was selling for a dollar, all right, because it was so hard to bring goods. All right, now, from the perspective of the Bay Area, that kind of increase in gold created a huge rise in prices, but that's what brought the people in. If you look at the, and they weren't complaining, they were digging the gold out. The miners had a lot of gold. They wanted other things. That drove up the prices. The merchants had a benefit. They earned a lot of the gold. They started buying from outside areas. What would be relevant is the impact on the United States and the rest of the modern world. And you could say the consequences did have very important similarities to inflation. And I could understand arguing that this, the California gold fields represented a kind of inflation in gold. But even that was of a strictly limited transient nature. There was some rise in prices from 1848 on for a while, but nothing very significant, and it didn't last. And from 1873 to 1896, prices fell almost every year. All right, you see, the gold standard, sometimes you might have a more rapid increase. But when the gold standard gives you its most rapid increases, they don't remotely begin to compare to what happens under paper money. When the Spaniards conquered the New World and seized all the accumulated gold of the Aztecs and Incas and opened many new gold and silver mines, it took an entire century for prices in Western Europe to triple. Now that's perhaps significant, but think how long does it take for prices to triple today in the least rapidly inflating paper money countries. So gold is not absolutely immune for limited periods of time from some increase in the quantity of money, possibly above production. But you also have to realize that at the same time, there were encouragements to fractional reserve banking, leading to increases in the quantity of money more rapid than the more rapid increases in gold. If you took that away, the problem would have been less. This gentleman, Dr. Binsman.
Yes, I want to support it as strong as possible, learn the logic of what you said about inflation and the gold standard. If you take the California experience of the discovery of the New World and so forth, those are all changes in price relationships stemming from facts of reality. When you're dealing with the government's expansion of the money supply, you're dealing with phenomena resulting from the government's attempts to circumvent and evade facts of reality. So to put them together under the same concept would be a complete violation of the whole purpose of concept.
Well, thank you very much. That sounds worth considering. I'll give that further thought. I thank you for your support. Last question now. This gentleman over here.
Yes, I have a picture in my mind where people's productive ability over time could increase more than their desire to consume, so that wouldn't that imply a falling rate of profit over a long time?
You say you have the idea that people's productive ability could increase relative to their desire to consume. There are periods in which that occurs when people become more future-oriented. If up to now we've had to worry tomorrow we'll be killed, consume everything today, now we decide we want to provide more for the future. So long as people are in a process of increasing their relative provision for the future, then they'll save and accumulate capital relative to consumption. But there's always a limit. People do want to consume more as well as have more provision for the future. They want to do both in a certain balance. And once they achieve a sufficiently high relative provision for the future, then they're prepared to consume on and on, almost in proportion to the increase in production. But I think we'll have an opportunity to go further into your question, and let me refer you to the series Introduction to Pro-Capitalist Macroeconomics that I gave here 4 years ago, also available from Second Renaissance Books, where I deal extensively with these issues, productionism versus consumptionism, and Say's Law. And we'll have some more to say tomorrow or Saturday. Thank you.